G'day, it's Daniel Harford. Welcome to the Best of the Breakfast Club on RSN 927. It was jam-packed. Check it out.
Whitey, good morning to you. Greet is good.
Good morning. I'm going well. Probably better than Jose Mourinho at the moment.
What's Jose done?
Tottenham led 3-0 overnight against West Ham United at the 82nd minute mark and managed to give up that lead with a 3-3 result.
Who coaches Tottenham? Jose coach Tottenham, is he?
Yes, he does.
Right.
You should know that, Daniel.
I should. I don't really care.
So he's had a bad morning or bad night his time.
Yes, very much so. Very much so. But apart from that, I'm going great.
So, West Ham, you need to give credit to West Ham.
No, because no one should be giving up a 3-0 lead after 82 minutes. I don't care how good you are.
West Ham, fantastic. What a performance. That's one for the ages, isn't it?
Mm. I think it's the first time in Premier League history that someone has come from 3 goals down after 82 minutes to at least get a point. It's a very Tottenham thing to do.
So it's one for the ages. It's fantastic. What a great performance by West Ham. I think we should be celebrating the ability to not give in, Whitey, to not give in, never give in. It's the spirit of sport, isn't it? Spirit.
It's a very Tottenham-like performance, that's all I'm saying.
Fantastic. Fantastic it is. Well done to West Ham. That's a win for the ages or a draw for the ages. And we'll talk about that tomorrow with Russ, I'm sure, to go through that. Never give in. It's the spirit of sport across the globe. It's one thing that Adam Ramanauskas sort of personified as an athlete across his time. It wasn't very good, so he just didn't give in. Bombers champion, these days manager to the stars. He joins us on a Monday morning. Good morning, Rama.
Oh, yes, very good morning. It's interesting. With the array of sport that we had over the weekend, Whitey's led with Tottenham.
It's the most recent.
I'll give you that, but geez, there was just so much sport to consume over the week. We spoke about it Friday, you know, how many hours were going to be spent on the couch, and it didn't let us down. You know, starting with Friday night's prelim final, which was absolutely fantastic. Now, all the way into, I suppose, Bathurst yesterday with probably a surprise winner, really.
Well, not necessarily a surprise winner. Not necessarily.
Well,
SVG. SVG is a serious. Well, we're barracking for Scotty because he's dominated the season. We wanted to go out of this year because we don't know if we'll see him again. This is the thing with Scotty McLaughlin.
Right.
We don't know if we'll see him again after his IndyCar sojourn, which is just a couple of weeks away when he heads off to the States to race. So that would have been nice for him, but he's won 3 championships in a row. Like, it's not as if he's had a rough trot. Our man, Scotty, he's dominated proceedings.
Well, I think we just got used to just seeing him win. You know, it's sort of, the day started with sort of Dan Andrews making his sort of speech and really not much changing, really. Let's sort of be honest here.
I did try and tell you that on Friday.
She did. Into the Melbourne Vixens, who were absolutely fantastic in that final. That just lived up to all expectations. And
that was unbelievable, that game. Then, it was fantastic.
It was a fantastic game. The Wallabies let us down. Eden Park continued to prove to be just a place they just don't like to play at. It's just any sporting team or any rugby union team that goes to play at Eden Park won't win. Then we finish with Bathurst.
Yeah, I don't reckon they would let us down, though, the Wallabies, did they? They just outplayed by a better team. This is the thing. They played out of their skin, I reckon, in the last game to come back and get the draw 16-all. But I'm not sure that they let us down. They just got pounced by a better team, I reckon.
Three tries in 11 minutes after half time. That was obviously the game changer. That was disappointing. So, but yeah, I think after last week's performance, you sort of, you know, there was, I even watched, this is sort of how much I was missing sport. I watched the replay of that game during the week on Fox Sports at one stage.
That's a great indication of where you're at the moment, Rama.
Yeah, yep. So
10-7 at half time. Look, going into the second half, you think, oh, hang on a second, we're half a chance here, half a chance. Got the late try in the end of the first half. So it was that element was disappointing, but I don't think they let us down. They're not good enough just yet.
Probably a bit unfair.
But they're emerging.
The problem was that the Wallabies made the All Blacks angry last week by getting that close. And I just wonder if they had their time again, the Wallabies, rather than settle for the draw as they did, even though they were deep in enemy territory, whether they would have actually perhaps been prepared to lose it to win it last week. Now, I know they had their shot, the penalty shot for goal to win the post. But it was their choice to kick the ball out of bounds last week and take the draw. I wonder if they had their time again, they would have done things differently. Who knows?
I reckon, yeah, it'd be an interesting question to ask, ask the coach or ask Michael Hooper, the captain, after his 100th test last week. But I reckon that was a good result, considering where Australian rugby has been, and we discussed this last week, where it's been to hit up a 16-all draw against the all-conquerings. Was a great start to their Blood Club Cup campaign. They're just not good enough yesterday. The All Blacks, as you said, would have been angry and went to work on the new Wallabies systems and found a way to get through it, which is what they've done for the last 20 years and effectively in rugby across the world.
Yeah. That, with that Melbourne Vixens, and I know we'll speak to Caitlin Thwaites a little bit later on, but... you're right, Half. That was an amazing contest. And one of the reasons why it was such an amazing contest, I don't think the scores at any point were any more than 3 or 4 apart. The Fever got the quick start. The Vixens got out by 3 or 4. But the two-point shot. Now, I know there's a lot of critical people in netball that don't like it because netball is such a traditional sport. But it added such a fascinating layer on a close contest. There was the two-point shot that Caitlin Thwaites missed just before half-time that would have given them a really good buffer, and then the Fever got a two-point shot pretty much on the buzzer to get themselves back really close. That gave them some momentum. And then at the end of the match, we saw Caitlin Thwaites actually land a two-point shot that gave them the buffer, and then... the Fever missed one late as well. So it added drama. And what it also meant was that it was unpredictable. When they went forward, do they sort of cover the player that is good at the two-point shot, or do they cover the under the post? It was really good to watch such less predictability in the way that the final sort of 5 minutes played out. It'd be great if it was for the entire game, but I thought it was a big tick for a new innovation in netball.
I've been thinking about that overnight. We had a discussion about this yesterday, you and I. I've been thinking about that overnight, whether or not it would have been any different had the two-point shot not been there, because perhaps those margins wouldn't have been as stretched in those key moments with 1 point through. It does create drama. You're 100% correct. Creates more drama. The fact that it is, and we've discussed this all year too, that the only the last 5 minutes of the quarter does seem a bit gimmicky, and I think that perhaps is the conversation with the netball purists. Why, yeah. If you're either going to do it, you're all in, or you leave it out if you're going to do a portion of the quarter every quarter.
Yeah, I mean, Sherelle is much more qualified to talk about this than me, obviously, but as a spectator and lover of sport, who likes to watch any competitive sport. The predictability of just giving it to the really tall girl under the post versus a little bit more creativity in the way that they may strategize going forward and to have the choice, I think is really important for the sport, because it makes it a much more watchable sport for the sports fan as opposed to the traditional netball fan, in my view.
A fantastic performance by the mighty Melbourne Vixens. What a season it was. And we're going to speak to Caitlin Thwaites after 8 o'clock. Probably deep in celebration mode, I hope. I hope up there in Queensland. Plenty of calls when I have their say on the water sport in the first little patch here, Ram. We're going to get to them shortly, but we'll get to you.
One that we forgot is the mighty Melbourne Storm.
Well, yeah, I haven't mentioned it. You're right. Certainly didn't forget it on Friday night.
No.
My thumb was very sore really. Friday night. Very sore. Flicking.
Oh, they were, I missed two of the tries because I just didn't have time to get back to the Storm.
This is where the two-screen system is critical, and I'm not like that. And I still haven't been like you, Rammer. I haven't worked that out yet either.
But they were terrific. They were into another grand final. You know, there's not enough words about the Melbourne Storm, just how good they have been. They've travelled longer than any team now. I think any sporting team, I believe, is that right now, Half? I think the the AFL players are just over 100 days. I think the netballers are about 90-odd days. Yeah, and I think the Storm are, I think they're up around 120, I think, now.
Yeah, they're up around that margin. Yeah, they're remarkable. Well, in fact, all of the teams, I mean, the West Coast Fever have been on the road for a long time in the Super Netballers, just like the Vixens. We've got Richmond and Geelong in the AFL Grand Final, which is remarkable considering the situation. Of course, the mighty Melbourne Storm, 30-10 winners over the Raiders in the prelim, and they'll play Penrith in the Grand Final, who were too good for the Rabbitohs, 20-16. Penrith have been a bit closer to home than others. But still, it's quite remarkable that the Victorian teams have had such a presence in all the major sporting codes through the winter, so to speak, in the back end of winter into the spring. It's just remarkable, and well done to them. The mighty Melbourne Storm, just brilliant to watch. It was over. Had a patch of 10 minutes again where they just blew the game apart. And they are hard to catch in that situation. Hard to catch.
Cameron Smith just controls the clock for the rest of the game.
On Cameron Smith, there was no doubt a lap of honour for Cameron Smith and Suncorp, who's been a great of Queensland Rugby League and Origin up there. There was definitely a swan song appearance from him at Suncorp, and he acknowledged that as he was taken off the field. He was cheered off the field. So there's no more secrets to what Cameron Smith's going to do, I wouldn't have thought. Whitey, this is it.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And he has kept it fairly quiet. I think there has been a sort of a general feeling that this was going to be it, but you're never too sure, particularly because he continues to play at such a high level. That didn't go too well for people that thought he might have been going on next year, I wouldn't have thought.
No, I wouldn't have thought so. Let's get some calls, boys. They're coming in thick and fast. And what about this one? Andy, our man over in the UK, wants to talk to you, Whitey, I think. Good morning, or good afternoon, evening, whatever it is for you, Andy.
Good evening. I'm just quaffing a glass of red wine at the moment in celebration of the mighty, 3-0 down to 8 minutes to go. And what happened, Adam?
Well, I tell you what happened, Andy. Tottenham were playing, and anything's possible.
Well, it did, and it was wonderful. I love it. I mean, I must say, first and foremost, I'm really missing not... I come over every year to Melbourne for the Spring Carnival, and I am missing not being there this year. I love it. And I'm sorry not to come, but this was very nice this afternoon. I must say, Whitey, very good.
Are you blowing bubbles, well, Andy, with all the West Ham fans?
Yeah, very delighted, yes.
Fair enough.
Well, Andy, as a West Ham supporter...
Well, we've gone through many hard times, but I must say, 3-0 down, 8 minutes to go. I wasn't expecting that.
No, I think the commentary, Andy, in the game is that Tottenham went from title contenders to back to Tottenham Hotspur in 10 minutes.
Well, it did seem it was the same old Spurs, wasn't it?
Yeah. But it is amazing, and you can give us some insight on just the whole thing about derbies, particularly London derbies in the Premier League. West Ham and Tottenham have played some crazy games over the course of the last 20 years particularly.
Absolutely, and I just think it's so sad at the moment when there's no noise. It's unreal. I mean, I'm a massive racing fan. I've been to races a few times recently, and there's just nobody there. It's like football fans. There's no crowd. It's awful, you know?
Yeah.
But, I mean, how are you finding it with the AFL? I mean, I have to also say that I'm a Richmond fan as well. I've been talked into that years ago. But how are you finding it? No crowds out there?
Yeah, well, I think the thing, Andy, is that when, particularly this time of year, when you start seeing highlights of previous final series, grand finals, and you understand how much the crowd is missed, I think it's easier in a way during the final series because so many of the finals have had fairly significant crowds, so it feels like normal. But it's just more the fact that at this time of year, you're used to seeing the MCG packed. And to think what the grand final would have been under normal circumstances this week with Richmond and Geelong, that it's not at the MCG, I think he's going to put a bit of a dampener on things. I think we've got two spectacular teams in the grand final, but the fact that it's being played at the Gabba is going to be very strange.
I've been to the MCG many, many times for the test match, for the Boxing Day test match. I mean, what will that be like this year? Will you have a test match there?
Well, they're the questions that are being asked at the moment, Andy. It's looking like, well, who knows? We're forecasting out a couple of months.
We'll talk about this in a minute, yeah.
It's a dangerous thing. But all going well, there will be an element. The MCC are confident that the Boxing Day test should and will be held at the MCG on Boxing Day, with a limited capacity, clearly, the way things are going. But it looks as though that it will go ahead at some stage.
Can you put a bookmark on that, please? Daniel, I'd like to get back to that in the next five or so minutes, because there's a bit of news about that.
I'm going to put a bookmark on that, okay? I'll do that for you. Hey, Andy, good luck to you. Well done to you and your West Ham boys. Great to have you listening over there in the UK, and we look forward to seeing you back over here when conditions allow it.
I'll be back next year, hopefully.
Good stuff. We'll look forward to getting you across then. Don't be afraid to call in any given week either, just by the way, particularly when Tottenham are failing. George is in Layla. Hello, George.
Good morning, boys.
Hey, yeah, man.
Man, I'm bad, boys, just to talk to you. It's such a big week in sport this week. I decided I'll get the week going.
Good on you. What do you got for us, George?
Oh, look, this is something that happened to me back in 1986. Those days, there was only two racing stations. There was 3DB, hosted by the late Bill Collins, and 3UZ, hosted by Bert Bryan. In those days, Bill Collins used to have this racing competition for the listeners, like I'm ringing you people at the moment.
Right, and what was the competition?
They used to pick four people, well, at random. They used to select four people, but you got to get through the phone, like now. And I was lucky enough to get through it, and we had to give him a listener's lucky launch shot, Lucky Rama launch shot, 10 to 1 or better. And I said, good, I was selected to on that particular year, 1986, you know, and that was the race between the Air Waverley Star and Barncrusher. You know, so for getting through and winning the competition that day, I got a ticket to the Mooney Valley Race Course, plus $50 voucher, you know. So fair enough, I said, I'm not going to waste this. I'm going to go and watch this race. In those days, you didn't have to reserve a seat or anything like this. It's just first in, first serve, you know, and you sit where you sit. So basically, I went up there, I met this horse called Tabor Zari, trained by Angus and Manesco and ridden by the professor, the late Roy Higgins. Up it comes up to 7-2, and I stood in that chair after that until the cock strike was over, you know. And it was the best cock splitter I've ever seen in my entire life. It was a race between two, you know, because of the press, they advertised that race as the race between two horses, Our Waverley Star and Bonecrusher. And, you know, there was no other horses in that race.
Well, that was an all-time classic. You're spot on. George, I hope you've been listening to some of the memories on RSN 927 through the last couple of weeks. The best Cox plates ever, according to all the superstars around here on RSN. Now, they've mentioned that one, of course, not as intimately as and vividly as you've just recalled it, just by the way, but 1986, what a Cox plate it was, the 100th year of the Cox plate. This year, of course, and we're building up to a big one on Saturday.
This is just, I believe that Dean Lester was also at times part of the lucky long shot where he was ringing up as a youngster. So the synergies between George and Dean just get that little bit deeper, just the two of them together.
Just brothers.
We've got to look at
brothers from another mother.
Well, I think so. I just think that there's a program with Dean and George together. Now, remember when we put them together last time, Dino, that George went to water. George got very, very nervous. He couldn't put two words together.
He was intimidated, he was. He was intimidated by our man. But that won't happen again because he's clearly gone and done some work. He's bettered himself in the off-season and he's ready to go. I think there's an opportunity. Should we put them together for George to dominate? Of course, it is Cox Plate Week. This week, we're very excited about that. Plenty of action from Mooney Valley coming up through the week and tomorrow, in fact, as well, Whitey, where we'll be across all the latest information in the Breakfast with the Best in the old days. Of course,
well,
be a bit different this year.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it is different, but the horses are still going to be out there and we'll be out there as well. So the barrier draw will still be done live tomorrow on RSN with Michael. Quite a few of the key gallopers or key horses going into the Cox Plate will be there also tomorrow morning, so we'll be out there very early. So we'll try and make it as normal as possible for Breakfast with the Best ahead of the 100th Cox Plate on Saturday.
We certainly will. We certainly will. Thank you, George. Nice to hear from you. Always nice to hear from you. Tony's in Frankston. Hello, Tony.
Get the boys. The tab's been closed for a few months. I said to my brother a couple of months ago, can you put a couple of bets on the Brownlow for me?
Yep.
And he went down to the tab. He said, what players do you want? I said, oh, I just want $5 each way, Christian Petrarca, Travis Boak, and Jack Steele. Anyway, he came back and he said, oh, I can't back him each way. I can only bet him win only. So, yeah, I wonder what the top four would have paid. Oh, yeah, it was pretty easy top four, I thought. But, yeah, I'm a bit shattered this morning because none of them won. I mean, Lockie Neal had it won at round 15 or something, didn't he?
Well, he almost had it won at round four. The way he was going, Lockie Neal. It was a long coronation, it was, for Lockie Neal, whose votes tally, 31 votes in 17 games, extrapolated out, as they did last night. Got him out to 40, they put him out to, in a regular season length, which would have been a record for Lockie Neal. And I reckon, Tone, it was pretty much won at round five by Lockie Neal, effectively. And he went on to put on an absolute clinic and win by 10. From, as you said, Travis Boak, who was one ahead of Christian Petrarca and Jack Steele, who had fantastic years as young men. And they'll benefit greatly from that recognition, I reckon, to those two. But it was a dominant performance by the Lion King, Lockie Neal. And he was magnificent in his acceptance speech as well, which we'll hear through the morning as well. We're trying to track him down. He's obviously got a bit on this morning, you'd understand. But we're trying to track him down as well, get him on like we normally do on The Breakfast Club.
Well, Tony, interestingly, from a punting perspective, Lockie Neal was $13 before the start of the home and away season. I must confess, I thought he would have been a bit shorter than that, considering how well he polled last year in his first year at Brisbane. And from round four, he had become the outright favourite at around about $4. So going into the count, he was $1.25. And if you look back now over the last 4 or 5 years, we really have had some, odds on favourites go on to win the Brownlow medal going into the count, and not just odds on favourites. I mean, Lockie Neal was $1.25. Dustin Martin was $1.05 in 2017, and Patrick Dangerfield was $1.16 in 2016. So, obviously in recent years, it hasn't quite had the drama of the count. Last year, Nathan Fyfe won around about $9-$10. But in general terms, the short price favourite is winning. The umpires seem to be getting it right.
He had nobody taking votes off him from Brisbane last night.
Yeah.
So 31 votes in 17 games is an enormous number. You extend that out to a 22 game season, he's up around 40, I think. So
yeah, which is exactly
Jared Lyons was 9. Jared Berry was 8. So.
Well, that's the. I mean, that's the key. I mean, that Brisbane won as many games as they did, and Lockie was the only player to get double figure votes. Just shows how dominant he is in that team through the midfield.
L. Neal, 3 votes, and I declare the winner of the 2020 Brownlow Medal, Lockie Neal of the Brisbane Lions Football Club.
Well done, Gil. Well done, Gil. It would have been nice to see Jimmy Bartel, the Triple Premiership player, Norm Smith medalist, and, of course, Brownlow medalist, who welcomed another one into the fold last night with Lockie Neal's victory for the Brisbane Lions. Would have been nice to see him up there present and put the medal around Lockie Neal's neck rather than the mannequin where he had to do it himself, which was an unusual setting, I must admit. Jimmy, good morning to you.
Morning, gentlemen. The previous year's Brownlow medalist normally has to present the Brownlow medal, so they couldn't stick with that tradition. So, it was the self-congratulations award of the year.
Surely, as was picked out by many and sundry watching last night, surely Simon Black could have done it. Jason Ekamanis is up there. You could have found someone.
Michael Voss.
Voss, well, he's
Michael
in
Voss.
He might be in Adelaide, so it might be a little bit difficult. But
yeah, true.
Vossie and Blackie. Coach. Sorry, Blackie and Acker up there.
Yeah, his coach. I don't mind that, Rammer. Even his skipper, Dane Zorko, someone like that could have been nice to say.
His girlfriend could have done.
He's not overly tall, so he doesn't have to bend down too far to get the medal on his neck. So, unbelievable season. I think a very popular winner. Look, you try to make a case for Travis Boak and the others, and I think it all finished about where we expected, didn't we? Lockie Neal was dominant. It's dominant through the first part of the year, but 31 votes in a 17-game season. Boy, oh boy, wowee.
What was your vote tally, Jim?
29, I think I got.
29? That's a lot of votes too. No wonder you won. 29 is a good effort.
I think your dog disagrees. Maybe it was only 28.
Mm. Yeah. Oh, was it 28?
No, I don't know.
I don't know. It was about 28, 29, but just for half playing at home, a couple of games up my sleeve, didn't need to play the last two games. But
give us a spell. It was 29 votes, by the way, James. 29.
Yeah, didn't play the last two, yeah.
Fresh enough for the finals, fresh enough.
I think one of the things that I'd like to just mention briefly is just how good it was the recruitment of Lachie Neale to come across from Fremantle. Now, I know that there was obviously a bit of a strain on the relationship for the Dockers that he was prepared to leave, but you've still got to get the deal done and you've still got to be the club that the player wants to go to. And when you look at the trade, it was Lachie Neale and pick 30 for picks 6, 19 and 55. So that was the exchange.
What was the exchange?
So they Lachie Neale and pick 30,
yep.
Going to Brisbane, and Fremantle 6, 19 and 55. Now, I think in the end, I'm not even sure whether they ended up staying that way. I don't think they did, but that was essentially the exchange. So Fremantle and Brisbane didn't have to overpay to get him. And the interesting thing about that was that essentially what they said was, and this is where I think it was really brave from Brisbane, is that they let a captain go in Dane Beams, and they sort of went, well, you know what? We're going to make the deal happen here where Neale will come in for Beams, who was very good for Brisbane at the time and was the captain, but they made a bold call. So I think, you know, it's not just because he won the Brownlow. He's been an excellent player for 2 years, but, geez, he's made an impact.
Yeah, and I think also the impact Whitey too has helped them with future recruits as well, that a very, very good player at the time. Like an emerging star at the time when he was at Freo. Like, he was a very good player, but he wasn't the star that he is now at Brisbane. But an emerging player picks Brisbane. And I remember being around that time that it wasn't anything to do with money or length of contract. It was actually he wanted to come to Brisbane. Like, not only... Yep. the Lions, but the city of Brisbane and that lifestyle that brings. And we're seeing more and more players who don't want to be part of the footy bubble. Like, they don't want to be day-to-day consumed by it. They don't want to be, you know, every time you flick on the car radio or pick up the newspaper, it's front and back AFL football. You know, it's... I know, speaking with Hodgie in the past, that was the best thing he loved about being up at Brisbane. It was like, it's almost... On the weekend, you can get your footballer on, and Monday to Friday, you just... Oh, well, I'm having a barbecue in 20 degree weather in the middle of winter and in the backyard, and I can listen to everything else apart from football.
And Jimmy, I think it's a really good point, and I think where you got to add to it as well is how good their medical team is, and maybe it's just the weather, I don't know, but Lincoln McCarthy, who was part of the reason why Lachie went up to Brisbane, because they could reunite the two of them as close friends. I mean, Lincoln couldn't get on the park at Geelong, and he's only missed a game since he's been at Brisbane. And even Grant Birchall, who missed so much footy in the last few years, goes to Brisbane. Now, I know he did his hamstring in the last game, but he's played a hell of a lot more football than I think a lot of people would have anticipated.
Yeah, they built a really good plan around Link McCarthy, and it was about playing football. It wasn't, again, contract. Look, the contract was friendly for both. Like, if Lincoln played more football, he got rewarded for playing more football, and for the Lions, it protected them as well. But it was a clear plan. It was, you come up here, clearly, yeah, your mate's committed in Lachie Neale. We're a young list. This is where you play, but most importantly, this is how you'll train, and this is how we'll try and get your body shape right, you know, to... take a bit of stress off, because he had a lot of stress-related foot and lower leg injuries. So this is how we'll get you back playing football. And also, it came at the right time. It wasn't like the fact that Geelong hadn't tried enough to help Link McCarthy, but it probably came at the right time, a fresh set of eyes, a fresh program, and a place to start.
And they did a hell of a job. That pick six, Whitey, involved in the Lachie Neale trade, is a storied pick in AFL football, because they... gave pick six for Neale. Don't worry about 16 and 58 or whatever it was, 55. So they gave six to Fremantle for Neale. Fremantle then passed that pick on to Melbourne to get Jesse Hogan. Melbourne then gave it to the Suns so that the D's could snatch Stephen May away from Gold Coast. And Gold Coast drafted Ben King with it. That's a pretty good story of a pick six in the draft. So lucky Neil for Ben King, effectively, sort of, in the end up. It's not bad.
Not quite.
It's close.
Do we know who the steak knives was? Do we know who the steak knives was at pick 30? There's always a steak knives.
Well, Brisbane didn't keep it. I don't know who it was in the end, but I was looking at it last night, but they definitely didn't keep it.
We'll check it. We'll check it out and see where that pick 30 went. Joe would be all over that back at RSN HQ. Jim, we got the right result last night. Did we get the right result across the weekend with Richmond and Geelong being our grand finals? We'll go through the games in a bit of detail shortly, but did we get the right outcome for footy in this COVID-affected season?
Any of the four teams would have been the right result because of the way they played the season, but it probably gives the AFL a tick for its bubble life because it could have been a quite big possibility that the two teams playing in the grand final would have stayed in their beds for most of the year and being in Brisbane and Port Adelaide. But the two teams who lived the bubble life in the last four have made the grand final, you know, Geelong and Richmond, you know, 100-odd days in the bubble, all that sort of stuff, hub life, whatever it's been coined. So I think it shows that it can work. But what it probably points to, and we touch on this nearly every week, and why I was so big about Richmond, Geelong, and those older, experienced sides, they're just better equipped to handle it. It's, you know, the ups and downs. There's obviously going to be different things pop up. We know with Richmond, Kebab Gate, Brooke Cochin Gate, all that sort of stuff. But they're experienced and well-organised on the field and when it comes to just the pure football.
And Geelong are the same. Jim.
And which gate?
Ghoulie Gate.
The Ghoulie Gate. Sorry, I forgot that one.
I forget the Ghoulie Gate.
But when you see these two sides play, they're always well drilled and well organised. It's if one goes out, they just plug another player in, and they know how to play the system and the role. We clearly know how Richmond play their football, and we clearly know how Geelong play the football. And Half, I think you've coined it really well. Maxwell Smart game. Grand final, chaos versus control.
Well, that's what me. Damien Hardwick mentioned that through the year when they played each other, so I can't claim any credit, but I think it's a fantastic way of looking at the game if you're just looking at styles of play. Richmond are chaos, Geelong are control. It's magnificent. You've got Maxwell Smart, Agent 86, and the Cone of Silence somewhere. It's fantastic.
and I think there's no doubt that's the case going into the grand final, but it was interesting, guys, and I'd love your insights into this, that it was what Richmond and Geelong both did behind the ball that under enormous pressure when the game was there to be won, neither Brisbane or Port Adelaide could penetrate the defences of the opposition. And we saw, you know, Port Adelaide pushing really late in that game against Richmond. Richmond had the answers. And then when Brisbane had to really sort of take off the handbrake and go for it when they got behind, they just couldn't score against Geelong. It was a real feature of both the Cats and the Tigers winning.
Yeah, before Rama jumps in there, both of them do what they do really well, and I've heard Rama speak about this. It's a defensive group. It's until you show them something, they're not going to adjust the way they defend. Now, Geelong aren't going to start defending the lead until you start actually hitting the lead. So when Brisbane, you know, are coming quick and they're bombing away and things like that, they'll just keep their back set. They'll take back shoulder, they'll roll over and help out, they'll get the outnumber. The wings always come back and help out, so they've almost, it seems like they've got seven defenders, and then they spread really well. So once they turn the footy over, watch Geelong and Richmond, how quickly then they set up attack or set up their exit. Like I saw one for Richmond, even in the wet, it was a free kick against Laddams, who gave away about 25 free kicks inside forward 50. But if you're looking for it, you'll notice, you just watch Edwards and the rest of the, who's near the ball, just go. They knew exactly where they need to go. They got width on the ground and they got length. So it sounds like it's not much. But what it does is, for Port Adelaide and for Brisbane, you have to quickly make a choice on the run while you're fatigued. Am I going out and, you know, trying to follow them, which opens up the middle of the ground, which both Geelong and Richmond like? Or am I trying to crowd the middle, which then those sides are just happy to take those easy ones wide and exit? So it's their ability to set up defence wide, but then it's almost like a click of fingers. They transition from one to another. We all defend, we all attack. We all defend, we all attack. And we all change our position of where the ball is as well.
So the interesting part on Friday night with the Richmond-Port Adelaide game, Nankervis was enormous in that last quarter, obviously, where he was, you know, he dropped into defence and was taking marks or getting the ball to boundary side for a stoppage. But The problem with that is Lysett couldn't float down because Port Adelaide were trying not to concede as well. So the ball would come back out and then Lysett would be in that contest. The issue that I found for Port Adelaide is because they went to the Dixon so often in that last quarter, they simply didn't have another strategy. When the ball, if Ned Curvis hit a market and the ball hit the ground, it was those yellow Richmond jumpers that we saw at ground level, either taking the ball out of defence or taking the ball towards the boundary line. So Port Adelaide didn't adjust in those probably last 5 minutes. Now, in a prelim final, you say, well, you know, it's chaotic. You just want to get the ball in. But Port just needed that little bit more composure, I thought, in that last quarter. Because they were doing all the, particularly late, Richmond early in that quarter did their work to get the lead. And then late in that quarter, Port Adelaide were doing all their work. But they just didn't have the composure going inside forward 50 to find another target. Now, that's when Marshall, I thought, needed to come into his own. He's the one that needed to work another angle rather than just going to that same contest and the ball just getting marked or ball getting spoiled. Then Richmond just continued to kick up and down the line. So that was perfect. Tom Lynch then drops back into defence. He takes a couple of marks. Vlosten was doing what he did because the opponent that Vlosten had simply wasn't dangerous enough. Port didn't. They just kicked the same angle inside forward 50 late.
So is that Port Adelaide not being experienced enough or not being mature enough to be able to not just go to Dixon all the time, or how much of the credit needs to go to Richmond that force you into doing those things because of how well they're set up behind the ball?
Yeah, an enormous amount needs to go to Richmond because, and Jim touched on that, like the way both Richmond and Geelong set up their defences are perfect. We've discussed this all year. The way to beat Richmond and Geelong is to separate their defenders. Soon as all their defenders defend together, you can't score against them. It's almost impossible to score against because they're just so good at coming off their direct opponent, coming third, fourth man into the contest and spoiling. So I think it is probably a little bit of a maturity thing for Port Adelaide. How do they isolate other players in Dixon? Now, any footballer wants to be the man in those big moments, critical moments. But I think from Charlie's point of view, he had to realise he almost had to be a decoy in those last moments, suck the players with him to then go to a one-on-one. Try get a Rosie in a one-on-one contest. Try get a Robbie Gray in a one-on-one contest to give yourself a chance to score. I didn't feel in those last couple of minutes Port Adelaide were going to score because they just kept doing the same thing.
They allowed the defender to roll off and have the extra defender then. They didn't equalise. Now, we were talking to Lee Matthews, sorry to drop a name, but talking to Lee Matthews across the weekend, he goes,
it's
the problem
with this one you could drop, to be honest.
he does have a statue. Yeah.
It's a twofold effect when you drop that player back into your defensive half of the ground like Richmond did. You're almost confining your defenders to being in the action for that entire period once you've done that late in the game, because every time you bail it out, it's going to come back in because the opposition's got the extra number. But if you don't match it up, it's going to be more difficult to score for the team that needs to hit the scoreboard, which, of course, is Port Adelaide in those dying moments. I was really surprised that they allowed that to happen. You might as well lose by four goals in the end. It's a preliminary final. No one cares what the outcome is. You might as well lose by four goals and try and hit the scoreboard, maybe even try and get a spare forward, like chuck two forward and see what Richmond do on the back of that. Because I just was surprised that they didn't match it up.
So, Jim, just in that last quarter, I spoke about Richmond doing their work early. So, last quarter alone, here's the key statistics. Disposals, Richmond +9. Contested football +8. Ground ball difference in a wet night +8. Clearance difference in the last quarter +12. And then time in forward half, they're at 55%. So, they played a smart game, Richmond. Early in that last quarter, let's do the work. Do the work, push as hard as we can, then we're going to trust our defence late.
Yeah, and it's no coincidence that they're both in the grand final, but when you watch these two sides and they get the spare or the extra number rolling back, it I love watching how both of these teams actually allow the spare to be the spare. And it sounds really simple how I've explained that, but I've seen sides who do this poorly throughout the year, and it's always a bugbear, is other defenders at younger, inexperienced sides, when they drop the spare back, they take it as a reason, just a license to drop further off their man. It's actually, when you have a spare defender, all your defensive group needs to be tighter on their man so the spare is actually emphasised and can come over and help you out. It frustrates the hell out of me when you watch young sides do it and they all start throwing the leg rope out an extra 10 metres. What ends up happening is everyone starts rolling up and you actually lose your spare advantage. Your spare ends up being so deep and having no impact on the game. So if everyone's tighter on their direct opponent, the spare can just watch the game. And this is what Richmond used to do with Alex Rance. They do it now with Nick Vlosten and things like that. Their spare is clearly defined and everyone knows their role. So when the ball comes in long and deep, the spare's not looking around going, well, there's one shooting up on the lead, or, like, say, if it's Richmond and it's Vlosten, he's not going, oh, Dave Asprey's left his opponent, get a little bit of a head start, he's going to have a free jump at the ball. So what you've got to do is you play really tight, then where the spare helps out is if something breaks down, they can come over and help out, and then the next one's really clear. But if they come man up the spare, well, then he puts his arm across and then the next one becomes really clear.
And that became really clear on Saturday night with Tom Stewart. So yep. Alice Yeoman comes in to play that role of trying to negate Stewart. It didn't work. It just didn't work. It was, I'm not sure why you bring a player in like Alice Yeoman. You bring him in to play inside mid around the contest, not to play on Tom Stewart. But in quarters two and three, when basically that tag on Stewart dropped away, Stewart had 15 possessions in those two quarters and just controlled the back line. He just shifted the chess pieces where he wanted you. We saw a number of times on the coverage they had to down the ground. And what Jim's talking about there, Stewart was just alone. He had, he had sort of 10 or 15 metres around him where he could dictate where he wanted to stand.
No, he was too good. We will get more in depth on that one, Rama, after the break, the Geelong and Brisbane game. Just on, I think one of the acknowledgements we need to make, well, certainly in my perspective anyway, from the game Friday night with the Tigers and the Par, is the performance of the Richmond midfield in the second half, and more than likely the midfield coach Adam Kingsley, who was able to identify at halftime a way to counteract the success of the Power at stoppages and clearances through that first half. In the first half, it was 21-12 in favour of Port around the stoppages. Now, the scores were even at half-time. Remember that, 3-3 apiece at half-time. So they're still not letting it affect them from a game sense perspective, but they were 21-12 down, Richmond, at half-time. They identified something at half, and I don't know what it was. I can't tell you that, but they identified something in a way to defeat Port Adelaide in the second half. And in the second half, the numbers were 29-8. 29-8. So plus 21 after being minus 9 at halftime in the second half. That is a story that needs to be told, because that's a not only the result of a midfield group that's got great trust in each other and their coach, but a coaching staff that's able to identify a problem and rectify it mid-game, Jim, and not wait till the end of the day and summarise it for the next game if they win, or for the next game if they lose in a home and away season. They identified it in one of the biggest games of the season, fixed it, and got their players to execute. I think that's a fantastic effort by whoever came up with the solution.
Yeah, and I think that just points to what a great side you have to call them. They have been a great side for the last 3 to 4 years, Richmond is, and I heard the stat on the TV the other night, since their premiership year, they haven't been beaten by the same side twice in a year. So that just points to their forward scouting, their learning, and their, as you said, identifying not only what they do well against the opposition, but what the opposition is trying to do to them. And they fix it, and they fix it within games, and they fix it also during a season. So well, Whitey.
Well, we spoke to Camden McIntosh during the week, and he said exactly that. We don't get beaten by the same team twice in a row. He actually referenced that, so clearly it had been one of the themes during the week. I'm interested in your thoughts on the conditions. As soon as it was wet, how much does that help Richmond, and how much did it take away potentially Port Adelaide's ability with speed through the midfield, which kind of got Richmond in trouble earlier in the year. Now, I know Richmond was a lot stronger personnel-wise in the prelim, but did it? Do you think it made a big difference in the match?
I thought it was enormous. I thought it was enormous because it made Port Adelaide turn into a kick mark team, which we spoke about on Friday. Whitey, you know, I didn't see Port Adelaide play on much through the middle of the ground on Friday night. So Richmond loved it. They just pushed up on the mark all night, made Port Adelaide go back off the mark, kick up and down the line a number of times. The times when Port Adelaide did move the ball, they looked enormously dangerous, and Richmond were, that's when they did struggle slightly. But again, you can overanalyze a game, and this will be Port Adelaide sitting there going, geez, how much do we need to work on here? They lost the game by 6 points.
Mm. Yeah.
6 points. So you've got to go, we've got to improve, absolutely. But I think the point that half makes is probably the most critical for Port Adelaide. What happened to our clearance work in the second half? Yep, Richmond dominated half. They changed their style. But what happened to Port Adelaide in that second half? Why did they fail around that contest so miserably in the second half, and particularly in that last quarter?
Yeah, and they probably have to take a little few days off. You let the emotion go out of it, and this is why I always talk about it with you, Half, is someone who's not emotionally attached day-to-day with Port Adelaide but is a good football brain, sit there and watch it with him, because then what you take out of it, Whitey, is was it the system or the individuals? Now, sometimes you can go, well, if we had our time again, we'd probably set up exactly the same. We got beaten just by talent, individual, grunt, work, whatever it may be. I'm not saying effort, because the effort was there, but sometimes the opposition just does it better than you. And then if you walk away from it going, okay, well, if this player and this player just was a little bit better in that contest and a little bit better in that contest, it could have been different. Or you go, well, no, they completely brought the wing in, or their half forwards come up and had a bigger impact. Well, then that... Yeah, is it the X's and O's, or is it the individuals?
Did we have an issue with the deliberate out of bounds?
Yeah, we did.
You did?
Yeah, we did, because it was... Well, we did because it wasn't consistent with what we saw the next night or what we've seen at times during the course of the year.
And I think that's the issue. That's the issue, I reckon, Ramo. I think to the spirit of what that law is, I didn't mind it, I must admit. But to what we have been paying through the season, then what we saw the next night, which was totally different, that's the problem.
I think on a wet night, and look, Jim's probably the best wet weather player that we've seen in a long time. You do kick the ball to the boundary a lot. You do kick the ball to the boundary a lot. And the ball skids on. Okay, so in a dry night, the ball doesn't skid, so it probably stays in play a little bit more. But as soon as the ball skids on and goes to the boundary, the umpire has to call. I think the biggest one was obviously the Hamish Hartlett one. You know, Lambert kicks that goal, and you know, Richmond obviously are then away in that last quarter. But see, I'm probably a little bit different. I don't think I had too much of an issue with it personally.
Yeah, but there's two arguments to this. It's whether you had an issue with it versus do we see the same interpretation week in, week out? So there's two different arguments.
Yeah, and I think we get trapped between the two different interpretations for the rule. The old traditional deliberate out of bounds, like deliberately did he put it out of bounds, compared to what they've tried to change it in the last 2 years is, have you done your best to keep the ball in play?
Insufficient
but
intent.
Jimmy, this is exactly right, and this is where there's a responsibility on the commentators and the media to make sure that it's educated properly, because people still see it as deliberate out of bounds. That's not what the rule is. So there is a difference in the way that rule is interpreted now compared to what it was two or three, four years ago. But it still needs to be interpreted the same way game to game.
But it's never going to be educated, because it gets people frustrated. It's like the MRP sort of stuff. Why would you educate people properly on the MRP? Because it gets people hot under the collar and becomes a talking point.
I was fortunate to spend time at Hawthorn. They won a flag in 2008. The next year they didn't make the finals.
The next year they got knocked out in the first week of the finals. The next year they got beaten in the prelim. The next year they got beaten in the grand final. And then they won three in a row. So it's a process that you have to go through, unfortunately. I was hoping that we wouldn't have to, but we met a team tonight who's lost a lot of preliminary finals, and they desperately wanted to get into a grand final. And they showed that in the way that they played tonight, and all credit to them. I thought that was a brilliant performance by Geelong.
Tough to argue with that. Chris Fagan, coach of the Lions, bowing to their opponents on the weekend, Saturday night at the Gabba. The Cats, too good. 40 points in the end, the margin. And it was about right, reflective of a dominant performance by the boys in the navy and white hoops. Jim, Brisbane never really, after that first quarter when Geelong didn't take their opportunities, never really looked like it. The Cats continued their demolition run through the finals campaign. Outside of that first week against Port Adelaide, where they played okay, just missed their chances, have been really emphatic with the way they've gone about it.
Yeah, they've got depth and they've got experience, and there is a point of difference to this Cat side from recent years is that they've got ability to change matchups within games when things aren't going their way. And their back six, look, you're going just speaking about the Brisbane game. If Charlie Cameron or Eric were to get off the chain, which Charlie Cameron kicked too early and they back Collar Jasny in and probably won that battle in the end, but they've got the options. So if Cameron gets away from Collar Jasny, you can go, do we try Stewart? Do we try Henry? Do we go O'Connor? If Eric, you know, kicks a couple, they can do the same. They can go, well, Henderson's there. Do we even move the bigger Harry Taylor if he plays deep? Even Stewart again can go across or O'Connor again. They can do that. And then forward of the ball, it's a little bit undersold that their power of the forward line. The little baldy man we know is a superstar, but you still have to put a lot of time into Myers because he can find space inside forward 50. You know what I mean? So they've got different matchups and things like that, which eventually, unless a big group was down like against Port Adelaide, they still nearly won the game. They're very tough to match up on the Cats. Well, if they had six or seven down against Port Adelaide, nearly won.
Yeah. Well, that's one of the things I think that we admire about Geelong and Richmond. Their evenness. While they've got stars, their evenness across the field is one of their great strengths. You go through just purely a very simple and raw statistic that I saw on the weekend. The 17 players for the Cats, Jim, had between 10 and 20 possessions. 17 out of the 22. Brisbane had 10.
Yeah, what the point of difference have been made, and you speak to Cats players and they say, oh, we haven't been focusing on it too much, but then you hear their backline coach, Matt Scarlett, in pre-game interviews just say what the players are either not listening or the coaches have done a good job. They've instilled it in them without them realising is their ball movement speed from their back half has gotten quicker. Now, whether the opposition's allowing them free players or not, they're still moving the ball quicker. What they're doing is, I think the Gabba has helped them a lot because you can get really wide, you can stretch the ground really wide in the Gabba. And if you watch down the ground for the Cats, is they're so well disciplined. And I spoke about this with Richmond the same. As soon as they turn the footy over, they get really wide and they force the opposition to go with them. If you go with them, they just ping you up through the middle because they catch the one or two out who are asleep. Normally it's a ruckman or someone like that, up through the middle. And you can play really dangerous football up through the middle of the Gabba. If you block up the middle, the Cats are happy to take the ball wide and forward and they just get into dangerous territory anyway. So, but they're doing it quicker. So if you want a visual of it, if it's Stewart or Blitzarves who intercept the footy across half back, they're making that decision quicker. They're not going all the way back behind their mark, waiting. Oh, we can only kick down the line. They're going back, going almost 1, 2, 3. There's the free, just take it. There's the free, just take it.
I want to talk more about Geelong because they're still alive, but from a Brisbane perspective, I'm interested, guys, because it just struck me that Port Adelaide, as you were talking about before, they're one kick away from a grand final. They might not need to necessarily do too much to be thereabouts again next year. Was Brisbane exposed? Because a lot of the problems we had during the year about their inability to kick the goals when they need to, they just looked a lot short of Geelong. But then they did beat Brisbane. They did beat Richmond a couple of weeks ago. Do we worry? Not worry, but have Brisbane got a lot of work to do to take the next step?
I think they need another midfielder to really help Lockie. I think I think Jared Berry is going to be a very good midfielder. There's no doubt about it. McCluggage on a wing's really good, but I think they need another one. They need another really good mid to help Lachie Neale. Now, whether that's a lot of people go, oh, you need a taller midfielder. You just need a good one. Just get a good midfielder into that mix that you know can consistently win the football, that can consistently play well in those big games. Now, now the forward piece is the other one that I've always felt that we've spoken about. You know, Hipwood and McStay are good players, but they weren't threatening on Saturday night really at all. The only threat was Charlie Cameron, and once Colajasny got control of that matchup, it didn't really look like the Lions had other avenues to score. Lachie Neale was the one that kicked a couple of goals. So he's having to do it in the midfield and then try kick goals as well to keep pace on the score. But their defence is solid. Darcy Gardner was a huge loss pre-match because just from a matchup point of view, he was able to play on Dangerfield. He could have played on Hawkins if needed. He could have played on Rowan if needed. So he could have even went to Gary Ablett if needed. So I think it's another mid and then the forward, obviously, in Joe Danaher.
Yeah, and if you're building the wish list out, the other thing I'd like to see, and it almost sounds like that they've missed the eight, but they need to just do what they do well and improve on top of it. But if they're building the wish list, I'd like to see from Brisbane if Alex Witherden try and win his spot back, because I felt like they got bogged down across half-back. Now, I know Daniel Rich is a kick, powerful kicking player, but Witherden or that attacking half-back who breaks the line first by moving forward, it helps him get out a bit of that rut and then actually kick-starts where they look most dangerous. Brisbane only looked dangerous against the Cats when the game was in high tempo, high speed, you know, going forward really fast. And if you've got one of those players across half-back who can generate speed naturally by as soon as they get the ball, they go forward by kicking or running or just creating something. And do you maybe, I know they got Marcus Adams in to help, and I thought Jackson Payne was fantastic for the late call up. Yeah. Maybe he might be the one they already have on their list. So they might already have it internally, but develop another player who can intercept the footy. And we know how important intercepting the footy is. Richmond have done it for years. Geelong have done it for years. West Coast, Collingwood, who have got a very good defence, they intercept the footy. Problem is, Harris Andrews is their best key defender, but he's probably their best intercept as well. Now, Saturday night, he's got his hands full, obviously taking care of big Tim Tam Tom. Now, if you've got another one, at least then, if you think Andrews is the matchup, the other one can come over and help out. He can generate attack, he can stop the opposition. So I just feel they're one intercept-style player. Now, they might already have it with Payne and Adams, or do you go look for one?
I'm key forwards critical and another good solid mid. I reckon that'll get things going their way pretty quickly.
Tip them over.
Yeah.
I don't think Joe's going to help their accuracy in front of goal though.
It'll be like a driving range. Beginner's night at the driving range. Bing, bing.
Just get him on the park.
He's a massive presence. So.
Oh, of course. He'd make a huge difference to them, but.
He's got to have five shots on goal most games. Now, where those five shots on goal go is a different conversation, but you can almost pencil him in for that many.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Yesterday, we had one of the great sporting moments of the year in the Suncorp Super Netball Grand Final. It was our girls, the mighty Melbourne Vixens, taking on the West Coast Fever, and boy, was it an all-time epic. And Caitlin Thwaites was farewelling the game. Yesterday, a last game along with Tegan Phillip for the Vixens, and I reckon she would have been biting some nails deep into the contest, and she's been good enough to join us, the champ, after the premiership yesterday. Katie, good morning, congratulations.
Good morning, there's no need to yell, Grant. No.
Has there been a good time had by one and all, has there, Katie?
Yeah, we went had some good celebrations. It was really really fun and just nice to be with all of the girls because it's been a very very long season this season. So
no doubt. How do you feel today? Apart from a little bit sore, how do you feel emotionally today, Katie?
I think it still probably hasn't sunk in. Like the whole thing, but yesterday, like I was just trying to embrace all of those things that I really like, normally don't like feeling the nerves before a game or, like, feeling sick before you're out to go out there and things like that that I don't normally like. I was just trying to embrace those because I know that, like, I'm not going to feel them again. So, yeah, I guess that'll go into the corner of my mind as one time that I actually didn't mind, you know, ripping off the strapping at the end and all of that kind of stuff. It's, I think, you know, down the track I'll probably start realising, oh, my goodness, I'm not actually going to do that again. And, yeah, it was pretty awesome. So.
Hey, Caitlin, we're absolutely thrilled for you. We obviously followed you pretty closely over the last, well, long time now, but to finish with the fairy tale is awesome. I want to ask you about that last super shot that you put in, that it was such a crucial moment, and you had missed a couple before that one, but to actually make that shot, take us through that moment for me.
Yeah, I think, like, we've been really good strategically at recognising those moments, like, throughout, you know, especially with the strategy around the super shot and things like that. Like, I feel like we've been one of the teams that's done that really well and recognised and known when those moments are. And for me, I think, like, knowing that MJ was under the post and that she was going to get the rebound and, you know, I think having those moments, and for shooters, we always talk about in those clutch moments, you want the ball in your hands and you want to be the one, you know, you don't want to shy away from taking that shot. And so, you know, even though I had missed a few and I was very well aware that my radar wasn't quite on the way that it has been in some other games, but also just recognising that moment and knowing that, right, well, it's now or never and I need to put that shot up. And, so I think it kind of rolled around, and I think the netball gods made it sink in for me because it definitely looked like it was going out there for a moment. But, I think we need to take our chances in those moments, and that, you know, that's what it's all about, isn't it?
Yeah, but, I mean, it's such a different role for you. You go from being the one that it just sort of everything goes through you to playing such a sacrificial role, not having very many shots. I mean, you were substituted on and off with Tegan Phillip throughout the course of the game. I mean, you didn't necessarily have that rhythm, which I'd imagine makes it even harder to take such a crucial shot to essentially win your team a title.
Yeah, I think, it was, and I think, like, playing goal attack more at the start of the year, I think actually getting myself into an understanding of, okay, my breathing rate's actually going to be up a fair bit higher than what it normally is at goal shooter, and you have to kind of take that into consideration as well. So actually just finding what that rhythm was. And sometimes you do at goal attack, you go, you know, 5, 6, you know, 8 minutes without actually putting a shot up. So to know those moments and to be able to still have that rhythm, understand the pressure, the responsibility, even if you probably haven't put a shot up in a while. Like, those are all of those kind of things that I've now become a lot more appreciative of the way that goal attacks play, because I've kind of experienced that firsthand myself. Even though, you know, being out there at goal shooter, the scores are going through the roof these days. Like, you're putting a shot up every 30 seconds, a lot of the goal shooters. So it's, it was very different, but it's, I'm just super happy. And MJ played that role great when we were out there. So it was, awesome.
So, firstly, Caitlin, congratulations. Now, what's your overriding emotions this morning? Is it one of relief that the season's over and you win? Is it one of sadness that you know you won't be playing again? Or what is it? Because I think, you know, obviously you win the grand final, which is fantastic, but at the same time, it's your last game of netball.
Yeah, I think I'm excited and happy. Like, that's the biggest thing that comes to me. But then the next thing is the, thank goodness we get to come home, we get to see our family, you know, we get to, that's kind of the next thing, is that sense of relief of, you know, it's all of everything that we've been through, it's been worth it because we've managed to get here. I think that kind of initial, like, happiness, excitement, you know, and feeling so proud of everybody that done so much to kind of get this up and running and happen, and all of our team that have been through so much. So I'm super proud of all of that. But then when my brain starts looking forward, I'm also very grateful that we're coming home soon.
That was the best of the Breakfast Club. If you want to hear the full interviews again, go straight to the website, rsn.net.au.